This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 18th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. It's time for our fortnightly theatre discussion. Joining me today, I'm delighted to say, is Matt Wolfe, theatre critic at the International New York Times. Fresh from a trip to the Big Apple, Matt's brought back a checklist of what, or maybe what not, we don't know yet, to see on Broadway this season. We'll be mulling over King Charles III. Will it see the same success in the US as it did here in Blighty? And we'll discuss Broadway debuts from Clive Owen and Keira Knightley in Old Times and Thérèse Raquin, respectively. All that and more, yes, more, coming up here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you with us, as always.
Thank you.
How was your trip to New York, first of all? Always good to get a report back. Good times?
The flights were good. The air crew were lovely.
Didn't
have to wait too long to get a cab. So that was good. I got to Broadway well.
Exactly. Getting there is half the battle, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Let's begin at Studio 54 for a stage adaptation of Émile Zola's 1867 novel, Thérèse Raquin. This sees Keira Knightley take up the lead role in her debut Broadway performance, no less. We've talked before about screen luminaries taking steps onto the boards. It's always what people want to know first. How did she fare?
Well, it wasn't very good, and she wasn't very good. However, I do feel it's important to preface that seemingly dismissive remark with two very important comments about her. One is that she is the daughter of a theater actor and a very well-known theater playwright, Charmaine MacDonald. So this isn't a case of, some film star who spent her entire life cosseted on movie sets thinking, oh, I wonder what it's like to, do a show 8 times a week. She actually was brought up in that world. She has done 2 plays in London, which weirdly she doesn't mention in the playbill for this on Broadway, which I think is kind of a mistake, because for the casual playgoer watching, they're probably going to think, oh, she doesn't know her way around.
She's just
parachuted
in.
Yeah, right. But she has done 2 plays in London. One of them, Lillian Hellman's The Children's Hour, extremely well. This isn't a play, I think, that really plays to her strengths. It's an adaptation of Zola's novel, as you say, by the British playwright Helen Edmondson. And it feels like, I don't know anything about the provenance of the adaptation, but it feels like a blueprint for a screenplay that for whatever reason, because movies are hard to make and plays are easier to get on, and this is just conjecture, didn't make it as a screenplay and now it's become a play. So it's very bitty and piecemeal. And for much of the first act, Keira Knightley's character of the poor sort of put upon but ultimately lovesick and yet ultimately doomed, Thérèse, doesn't say very much. I mean, she's on stage a lot, reacting, responding, pining, but the role as written is virtually mute, at least for the first sort of half of it. And that is the kind of thing, of course, on camera it wouldn't matter. And in fact, it could be quite enticing, very smoldering, how much is communicated without having to say anything.
And with a nice alluring score behind it.
Yeah, exactly. And wonderful close-ups of Keira's, quite extraordinary visage. But, plays are a different animal. This is clearly a text-driven event. And the weird result of this is that she seems to recede from the action of her own play, which probably isn't very helpful. And the design by a really rather striking New York designer, Beowulf Barrett, there's a name for you, is very beautiful, but also very pictorial. So very often she seems kind of dwarfed by her surroundings. So I don't really think that the production helps her very much, given that people are possibly going to be saying, she's not really a theatre animal to begin with.
It's interesting you mentioned the staging then, and some of the reviews have been very complimentary about that, saying it's astonishing, astounding. Is it one of those things which for the actors is probably bad news, where in some respects the staging is the star almost?
Well, yeah. I mean, for instance, when they're kind of changing landscapes, and there's a whole bit early on about Thérèse communing with nature, and she can't speak to the grim, enclosed, suffocating environment, French environment in which she exists, but she is at home with rivers and streams, as one is. And so she'll sort of go out and kind of commune to the rushing torrents of water. But as soon as she gets back inside, it's like a prison. So literally that's suggested in this design, where this extraordinary set just seems to kind of descend from up above. And it's very, very elaborate, but it also is like a kind of extravagant cell. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot for her to compete against. And the supporting cast, there's another British actor in the production. She's not the only one. Matt Ryan, he's not as well known, but he's done Broadway before. He was Horatio to Jude Law's Hamlet. He's pretty good, actually. He plays the guy for whom she's pining, and then, without giving too much away, it doesn't end very well. But a lot of the other supporting players look like they stepped out of kind of Dickens adaptations. You know, that thing in Dickens where you pick kind of one personality trait and you kind of push it to the nth degree. So the other thing which is interesting is that she's just had a newborn in real life. So you kind of think, wow, with a new baby at home, is this really what you want to be doing 8 times a week, twice on Wednesday, twice on Saturday, especially as the mom? Mm. So one wonders if there isn't a lot else preoccupying her mind.
Well, it does seem almost like some of the stuff that's happening off stage. Well, that's rather been the story of the play. A lot of the focus was on, you know, injuries to actors, behaviour of people in the crowd for some of the early nights. It seems almost like one of those shows that maybe somehow just doomed to not really get off the ground.
Exactly. I mean, you allude to, quite rightly, there was a lot of drama before this production even opened. It was, I think, the first or second preview. Some guy in the circle of the theater kind of declaring undying love and saying that they were going to get married. I guess it hadn't occurred to this person that she's already married. But anyway, who cares about these details? And he was throwing bouquets of flowers onto the stage before he was carted out by security. And, you know, it isn't hard to get into these theaters in New York because the entrances are all at street level. Mm. It's not like London where you have to go down layers and layers and layers of floors. It is all on one level usually. So he was got rid of, and then she sustained an injury during the performance. So one doesn't want to come down too hard on her. I think it's kind of valiant that she's even doing it, but I hope she returns to New York at some point in different circumstances.
Thérèse Raquin is on at Studio 54 on Broadway until the 3rd of January. Let's move on, Matt, to the American Airlines Theatre for Douglas Hodges' production of the Harold Pinter play Old Times. Hodge has had a close relationship with Pinter plays throughout his career as both actor and director. Is this his first dalliance with this particular work?
Douglas Hodge? Yes. Certainly he's never acted in it. He wouldn't have directed it. So yes. When Pinter was alive, and of course Pinter has been dead now for quite a while, but when Pinter was alive, Doug Hodge was part of several productions, some of which Pinter was in fact in. So Doug Hodge really does have a close relationship with Pinter, and I think understands his work from the inside out. I happen to love Old Times. It's one of my favorite Pinter plays. I've seen many productions of it in London. There was a wonderful production a couple of years ago with Rufus Sewell and Kristin Scott Thomas. And it's a play that's very short, so if you don't like it, it's over quickly. If you do like it, it's kind of mesmerizing and tantalizing and teasing, and it's a play that famously withholds its meaning. You don't really know what it's about, and every time I see it, I think I understand it less. But actually, that's one of the things I like about it. I'm sometimes not so sure, particularly on Broadway where theater tickets are $150 and upwards, that if New York audiences, who also often are older than London audiences, if that's what they're paying, they want to know what they saw, what actually happened.
Who won?
Yeah, who won? Well, yeah. Who won is exactly right, Tom, with this play. That's exactly right, because as with so much Pinter, it's a play about power and control. And Clive Owen plays very well the one guy in the play called Dealey, who has a wife, and then the wife has a best friend who may or may not have had a past with Dealey, or the best friend may have had something going on with the wife, or maybe the two women are versions of one another, or maybe everyone in the play is dead and this is just all a fantasia, or maybe we just dreamed that we watched it. But it's one of these plays that is tantalizing. Elliptical. And Pinter, when asked about it, used to dismiss the question. He wasn't interested in explaining his own work. It is famously whatever you make of it. I like this production to to a point, particularly Clive Owen and particularly the wonderful Eve Best, who plays the best friend who comes to visit Clive Owen and his wife, Kelly Riley. Eve Best is sort of this shimmering, almost diaphanous figure in white, and she really does look like, is she spectral or not? Whatever she is, she's very erotic, and it's a very erotic play. And it's a play about memory and whether things that happen might not have actually happened. But I'm not sure Doug Hodge entirely trusts the American audience to get the play. For instance, there's a lot of ambient music provided by Tom York of Radiohead that you hear when you're entering the theater, which has obviously nothing to do with Pinter's landscape. And I have a feeling Pinter, were he there to see it, would not have liked that at all. Mm. And the famous thing about Pinter, of course, in his text are the pauses, the Pinteresque pauses. So what's Doug Hodge done? He's taken them all out. So it's very, very fast. The whole thing is like 70 minutes. And the last London production was 90 minutes. Well, that's a big difference.
Yeah.
With the same text.
20 minutes of pauses, sound about right for scholars of Pinter.
But it sometimes seems as if they're running a marathon, and it makes you realize that the pauses add to the meaning.
What about the staging? It's interesting. You wouldn't normally ask you what a play sounds like, and you've already mentioned this music by Tom York. Does it sound then like, is it too fussy? Is it too...
Well, I think the staging is a little, it's a little too self-conscious for my taste. It's not a naturalistic play, so it can sort of be set anywhere. But with this production, it's a little too clever. They've got, well, I assume it's meant to be, although I don't think it really is an actual one, but it looks like a big block of ice, kind of impenetrable block of ice, or immutable, which is kind of there, like something very chilly and forbidding. But then there's kind of this weird sort of vortices painting that looks like a Bridget Riley canvas on kind of overdrive. And you sit down, and between that and the music, before the actors have said a single thing, you're already slightly dizzy. And then because Pinter's language itself, although it's quite aggressive and pointed, it's on the down low, as it were. Mm. People don't yell at each other. Mm. They say pointed things, but they say them quietly. But it's as if the language has to compete with this wild and crazy design. Is the block of ice going to melt? What's going on with the Radiohead music? There's a lot of stuff.
It's a complex piece, I sense you mean.
Yes.
Well, you can go and judge it for yourselves. You can see Clive Owen's performance in Old Times until the end of the month at American Airlines Theatre on Broadway. Let's end the show, Matt, at Music Box Theatre, where King Charles III is on show after a very successful stint, we should add, at the Almeida here in London last year. Very well received, well reviewed over here. Mm. Same story, different story. How's it faring in New York?
It's faring incredibly well. I mean, this play has been the wild card of the season because, you know, Clive Owen and Keira Knightley are known commodities. They're both Oscar nominees. They're film stars. They put bums on seats before they open their mouths. King Charles III has a wonderful British actor, Tim Pigott Smith, playing the title role of Prince Charles at such time as his mother has died and he accedes to the throne. But, I mean, he's not a star the way the other Brits on Broadway are. And I suspect that the timing of this was partly to dovetail with the success last season on Broadway of Helen Mirren in the Audience, in which, of course, she played the Queen. And New York went nuts for her, and she won the Tony Award. And I was told there wasn't an empty seat in New York for the entire run. But of course, Dame Helen Mirren playing the Queen in the Audience is a very different proposition from this. And this is a much darker, angrier, more savage play. As you say, it began at the Almeida in Islington. It then transferred to the West End. So this is its third iteration. And actually, and this isn't always the case when British plays go to Broadway, but I think it's better on Broadway than it's been anywhere else. Maybe there's something about the fact that Mike Bartlett, who wrote it, and Rupert Gould, who directed it, they're sort of doing it for an audience for whom the landscape of the play, this isn't their first language. I mean, yes, we all speak English, but here there's just so much about the worlds that's a given. And you can put it up there and people know what you're talking about. Whereas in New York, there isn't that absolute familiarity, especially once you move beyond the Queen, you know, and Prince Harry and William possibly. But beyond that, do people really know what's going on? So I think the play is clearer, tighter. It's a beautiful ensemble piece. They've brought over the cast that did it in England, and they all seem to have upped their game. Mm. For instance, Oliver Chris, who plays Prince William, which was a part in London I thought was kind of thankless and a bit decorative. And Richard Goulding, who played Harry, got all the laughs because Harry is kind of a figure of fun in this, at least for the first part. And as Harry often does in real life, he seemed to run away with the events. But somehow in New York, they've recalibrated it. Oliver Christ has found more muscularity to his performance. The play is called a future history play. That's what Mike Bartlett calls it. So he's toying with the Shakespearean-ness.
Well, I was going to ask you about that.
Does the idea.
Does it have that idea of, you know, the traditional depictions of British monarchy on stage? You know?
Well, yeah. And what Mike Bartlett has done very cleverly. I'm not as great a fan of the would-be blank verse as some people. I think actually as an exercise, that bit of it could be better. But conceptually, I admire what it's doing. And I think it achieves that, which is to give King Charles, projecting him into the future and then giving him the dimensions of something of Richard II, you know, God knows Shakespeare wrote enough monarchs. So, and there, the play is peppered with some veiled and some not so veiled references to other Shakespeare plays. And Tim Pickett Smith, who was a, you know, wonderful classical actor, brings, 50 years of seasoning in the repertoire to this contemporary imagined character, because we don't know what will happen when Charles becomes king. Maybe he won't become king. So, you know, there's a lot of supposition, but it plays really well. And the New York audience is absolutely lapping it up. And now they're trying to figure out how to extend it, and maybe it'll be a movie.
It's got the ring of movie about it, hasn't it? King Charles III is on at the Music Box Theatre on Broadway until the end of January next year. Almost at the end, Matt, but before we release you from Midori House, anything else you saw that's worth a mention? You've been a busy man. You have scores of playbills before you.
Can't get to the door of the flat for all the playbills. Well, just very briefly, let's fly the flag for two, because it makes it sound like the only thing New York does is play host to Brits, which isn't actually the case at all. And there's a lot of very American stuff. And if I can just flag two American shows off Broadway, one is by the contemporary composer Michael John Lacusa, who's kind of been billed as son of Stephen Sondheim. They're in kind of the same artsy world. And it's a show called First Daughter Suite. And it's four kind of independent but thematically related musical theater playlets about the daughters and also the wives of past American presidents, not Michelle Obama and Sasha and Malia, but the ones from 10 Years Gone. And it's partly satiric. It's also very moving and beautifully done. It's a wonderful production. And if you like kind of adventurous musical theater, that would be one to see. The other is a play off Broadway in a tiny black box theater called Ugly Lies the Bone. And the star of that is Mamie Gummer. Now, she's an actress who is better known because of her mum. Her mum is Meryl Streep.
She's done a bit of acting work, I think.
And Mamie Gummer was with Meryl in the recent film Ricky and the Flash, and she was very good in it. This really, I mean, whether she's going to be the next Meryl Streep, who knows, but she can absolutely hold her own on stage brilliantly. And in this, she plays an American veteran of war who returns home to Middle America and watches her life implode, and she does it really brilliantly.
So a couple of little gems there
to look out for.
Matt, thanks very much for being with us. As always, that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks to Matt Wolfe for joining us, fresh back from New York here in studio. This has been the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Thanks to our producer, Holly Fisher, and research team of Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie Waters. Join us again at the same time tomorrow, our weekly book review coming your way. But for now, thanks for listening.